Welcome to Writers' Voices with Monica and Caroline. I'm your host, Monica Hadley. And with us today is Goldie Taylor. Now, Goldie is currently an editor-at-large at the Daily Beast, and she is a veteran journalist, cable news political analyst, and human rights activist who has written about national politics and social justice issues for over 30 years. She's been featured on NBC News, MSNBC, ABC News, and more other shows than I can count. And she is with us today to talk about her memoir, The Love You Save. Welcome to Writers' Voices, Goldie.
Thank you for having me. Thank you for this conversation, Monica.
Oh, it's my pleasure. So, The Love You Save is a story of your childhood, and man, it's painful.
Sure. Yeah, I think in a word, yes. Even now, and I'm turning 55.
Wow. Why did you decide to write this now?
You know, I just think there comes a time when I think we as people understand that we're carrying around too much. And in my telling, I am carrying around the burdens, the secrets of others that I no longer felt a responsibility to do. In fact, I felt an obligation to myself to put those bags down, to turn the page for myself, for my now grown children, for the glorious grandchildren that I have. And so in many ways, this was a bit of personal liberty. But on the other side of it, there was a broader conversation that I wanted to have about social pathologies that beset this country. I wanted to talk about poverty. I wanted to talk about gun violence. I wanted to talk about addiction and drug abuse and sexual violence. I wanted to talk about domestic violence. I wanted to talk about the bifurcation of education in our public schools. There were so many broader national issues that I wanted to talk about, but not debate them per se. I wanted to give the reader a perspective that maybe they had not been accustomed to seeing. I wanted them to take them inside of the world that and the people that populated my world. I wanted to take them inside of the schools I attended, inside my father's murder, inside my brother's addiction, inside of the sexual violence that I endured as a child, inside the domestic violence that my mother and aunt endured. I wanted to be frank and candid and just give a perspective on these issues that I think we see far too little of.
Well, you definitely did that. This story, you grew up in East St. Louis, and whenever I've talked to anyone about this book, and I say that, it's like everybody knows the reputation of East St. Louis, or at least yes. Everyone here in Iowa, which is where I am.
Oh, certainly.
And
I send a great many students to Iowa for school, our standout athletes out of East St. Louis. They make a beeline for Iowa. The tough thing, though, is that Iowa is known for having an exquisite educational system.
That used to be.
East St. Louis is known for not.
Yeah, yeah.
So it's tough for our students to navigate once they reach someplace like Iowa where there's a quality basic education.
Wow. Yeah. And how do you solve that problem? How do you, I mean, that's a whole nother conversation about how, but let's go back to your book and your story, The Love You Save. So you were raised partially by your mother, partially by your aunt and grandmother and uncle. And is this a common situation in the community you grew up in where you're sort of shifting between homes?
It was and it is today. Social adoption is quite prevalent among African-American families who are among the poor and working poor, that when there is someone who is in prison, someone who needs a helping hand because she's working an overnight shift, 11 to 7 in the morning. When there are people sort of living on the margins, then we as relatives step in to embrace, wrap our arms around the children when it's possible. And so in my old neighborhood, it was not uncommon for children to be living with their grandparents or with an aunt or an uncle or even with an older sister or brother who was raising them. There was children living in foster care was quite prevalent, in at least in the middle school where I attended. Today, I am raising my eldest granddaughter, who is 9. Mm. And so multi-generational homes, social adoption is quite common among African-American families. And principally because, you know, we are less likely to place a child up for adoption outside of our own communities. We are less likely to willingly give up a child from our own communities. Mm. It's a cultural issue.
And it can be a good thing.
Yes, absolutely. It can be a good thing when you've got a family safety net that operates in that way.
But it also can lead to trauma if too much burden is put on people who don't have the resources to handle it.
That's absolutely right. My aunt and uncle never turned a single child away. So their door was constantly swinging open, caring for their own children and those of others. And it really didn't matter if they were blood relatives or not. If they were close enough to my aunt and they had a child in need, she would take them in without any question. And so it was quite a casual thing in our family. There were never, I must say, any formal adoptions. So no going to court and looking for guardianship, none of those kinds of things, because the parents would still be involved in something. There would still be someone available to them to take them to a doctor or to help get signed up for school. So parents weren't out of the picture. They just became not the primary caregiver.
And your aunt, you know, it's an interesting, the way you handle talking about your aunt and uncle, it's you're kind of walking a delicate line in a way, because you are expressing both appreciation for what they did for you and describing the ways in which particularly your aunt was cruel to you. Mm-hmm. And how did you walk that line, and how do other family members react to you having told these stories?
I think first and foremost, where my aunt and uncle were concerned, I loved them without ceasing. They're both passed on now. But I have no deeper gratitude than what I have for them and the home for which they tried to prepare for me. Sure, there were a great number of traumas that I experienced living in that house, sexually abused by an older cousin who turned out to be one of their grandchildren, that another cousin who brutalized me, that hit me like a punching bag. There was quite a bit of that happening. What I will say about them, though, is, especially where my aunt is concerned, people love you how they can. She was an angry woman because she, too, had experienced many of the same traumas that I had endured. She brought that to our relationship and to every relationship she ever had. As we laid her to rest a few years ago, it gave me pause to think back on those years and how generation after generation in our family that we seem to be handing this down like baseball and apple pie. The line I walked was, I wanted them to have the level of context. My mother, my father, both grandparents, I wanted them to have the level of context that I would have wanted for myself. If someone was going to present my story, I would want them to present it in as full of a picture as they could. Sometimes when we're capturing people at their very worst moments, it's easy to forget what was good about them, what was loving about them. I didn't want to miss that in this book.
Well, I think you did. You were able to do that. And your mother, too. You know, she in some ways neglected you, but you could tell there was still love there. She was doing her best too.
What I know today is my mother didn't have two nickels to rub together when she finished work at the Marriott at night and worked an overnight job after that, and after paying rent and trying to keep her car on the road and other expenses of raising three children on your own. that my mother was single. Her husband had been murdered in 1973. And throughout the 70s, she was struggling to survive, cope, and make it. And that meant sometimes having your children on their own while you went out to win the bread, because there was no other breadwinner. My mother never took a food stamp, never had AFDC, Family Defended Children. She was never on Medicaid. No social programs whatsoever did she allow into our household, and neither did my aunt. I think their burdens might have been a bit lighter.
Yeah, why were they so adamantly opposed to taking those benefits?
They were working people. They believed in an honest day's work for an honest day's pay. And so the only entitlement that ever came into our house was a survivor's benefit that came in my name because my father had been murdered. Mm. And my aunt, my grandmother had to convince my mother to apply for that. And so there was and there still is in our family, a sense of personal responsibility that I think sometimes that we're a bit too zealous about it.
It sounds like it, because those programs are there for a reason. and you know, to me, someone who's working deserves them more than someone who's not.
Sure. My mother believed in being her own safety net.
Yeah. And having family as a safety net to some degree.
Absolutely.
Yeah. The thing that was so hard to understand or to read, actually, and so painful, was that there were two things. One was the reaction and lack of help that you got when you were assaulted as an 11-year-old.
You know, I, as a grown woman, I look back, and I say that the story for me isn't that I was assaulted at 11. It was what came after, or what didn't come after.
Right.
That, you know, I was 51 when I sat down to write this book. For me, why wasn't there a police officer interviewing me at my home? Why wasn't there a social worker involved, or even my pediatrician, or our family's general practitioner in St. Louis? Why weren't there school counselors maybe involved? But then I thought about the context of where we lived. We were a Black family, one of only three, living in St. Anne, Missouri at the time, where we weren't all that welcome in the first place, that there were neighbors across the road who were grousing about all the Black people, all the N-words moving in. Polish man who, you know, had been someone else's a ne'er-do-well at some other point in his life, an unwanted.
Right.
So we were not wanted to begin with. And then I'm assaulted by a white teenager in our town. You've got a Black woman working double shifts, raising children. I don't know if I could expect her to walk into a police station and lay me at their feet and trust that I was going to get any more care than what I was getting now.
Well, that's a good point. But then why did it feel like she and other members of your family blamed you for the assault?
That is the place that is my point of pain.
Yeah.
It isn't that I went to live with my aunt because, frankly, it was someone to watch me 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, that I would not be left home alone again. So I'm fine, I think, with that. The piece for me is, and I talk about this in the book, about the notion of bad tale girls. That's another cultural thing among African American women, among African Americans in general. It's spelled F-A-S-T, but it's pronounced fast. And when you call a girl fast, and it's always a prepubescent young girl, you know, someone who was under 13. It means that she is already sexualized in a way that she is wanting the attraction of grown men. That she is walking in a way, carrying herself in a way, dressing in a way, modeling herself in a way as to attract the sexual attention of adult men.
Well, she doesn't have to do anything if her body just if she just matures early, exactly. There's nothing she's doing.
That is exactly right. That is exactly right. This is so prominent in African American community. It sickens to me, actually. It sickens me when I see it and hear it. And when we are assaulted, you know, when we are in a situation where we don't have, you know, the kind of maturity that it would take to even give consent, we are then blamed for our own victimization quite often.
Yeah.
I don't know that a lot has improved about that, by the way. I don't know that a lot has improved culturally around that. But I know at least in my day, in our day, 70s, 80s, 90s era America, that a fast-tail girl was like the scarlet letter A.
It breaks my heart because girls that age they have no understanding of what's going, you know, of why this is happening.
Oh no, I carried, Monica, for 40 years the stigma, the blame, the shame of believing it was my fault. It was only when I began to write this text and become my own witness did I, you know, did I shake myself and say, what, are you kidding me? You were 11 years old. What could you possibly have done to be culpable or to hold yourself in any way responsible? Grown-up Goldie had to go back and tell little girl Goldie that this was never your fault.
Wow. And it just breaks my heart that there was no one there to tell 11-year-old Goldie that at the
time.
There
was one. My grandmother, Catherine, in Florida, who led a very different life than we were living in St. Anne and in East St. Louis. My grandfather and she were fairly well-to-do. And my very first visit, the winter of 1980, my mother sent me to stay with them for the holidays. And my grandmother noticed that the young girl who got off the plane was very different from the one who'd gotten on the plane a few years before. That her 8 or 9 year old granddaughter, who was bright eyed and bushy tailed and excited about every single thing in life, the one who got off the plane was broken spiritually and physically. And so she set about those next few days taking me to Burdine's to buy dresses, to do my hair, and, you know, to get me into the shape of a little girl again, she said. Mm. And she sat down to do my hair that night. And I think she noticed that my eyes drooped, you know, that I was a bit downcast. And she wanted to know what happened. She had no idea about this incident, but, you know, what's going on with you? And I told her a little bit, you know, here and there. She goes, no, I need you to tell me the rest of it, child. It was that night that she sent my grandfather back out for ice cream, took me to her bedroom, and she laid me across her lap and said, okay, tell me what happened to you. That was the only night that I was able to fully describe my assault, what happened after that. She had many questions for what my mother did or didn't do, what my aunt did or didn't do. She had many questions for that. And I think there was probably a conversation after that that I, you know, was not, of course, privy to. But it was she who assured me then that there was nothing wrong with me, that I wasn't dirty. I know now that I didn't believe her, but I know that that is what she told me, and that she needed me to believe, she needed me to embrace that I was okay.
And after that, you wanted to go live with her, but why do you think that wasn't possible?
Oh, I begged and begged, in letters and collect phone calls to Florida if I were ever there on a holiday or simple couple days worth of vacation. I would ask again and again. And I know that my grandmother consulted my mother. And we talked earlier about that survivor's benefit. You know, living with my aunt in East St. Louis, that did not have to be given up. If I had lived in Miami, however, if I had moved in with my grandmother, that survivor's benefit, which our family depended on to survive, would have gone to my grandmother, Catherine. She was my father's mother. And so I think that is part of the reason. I think the other part of it is my mother didn't want her late husband's family to believe that she failed.
Mm. Plus, she probably didn't want you to be that far away where she'd hardly ever get to see you.
She probably would have seen me maybe once or twice a year, or once every few after that, if that were the case.
Yeah. You had an older sister, and at one point in the book, I'm thinking, why isn't this older sister maybe stepping in and helping out? But you don't talk about her very much.
No, Lori Ann, for the first part of my life, kindergarten through most of elementary school, was my primary caregiver. She was the one who bandaged scraped knees, cooked meals. She was, 7 years older than I, which didn't make her very old when you think, 7 years older than a six-year-old is just 13.
Yeah.
But she was, through her teen years, my daily care, making sure I got in from school on that school bus, making sure that I brushed my teeth in the morning. That was Lori Ann who taught me to comb my hair or to fry an egg in the skillet. She taught me how to bake a cake or make cookies from, her home ec class. She married early. She was 19, married a high school sweetheart, and was with a child. Her first baby was born when she was 20. So Lori wasn't living with us anymore. She was married and had a growing family of her own. And so she was absent from my life for much of these years between the age that I address in the book, between 11 and 16. I simply didn't see much of her.
Mm.
She was full-time, working a full-time job, raising babies and married and living in another part of the town. And so she's missing there in my life. But I will tell you that when I look back on, those very early years, especially elementary school, she was the stand-in mother as an early teenager.
I was thinking about that the other day, about some childhood things too, and as an oldest daughter and second of five kids, but the oldest girl, oldest kids don't get to stay kids very long.
In
a lot
long.
Of families, yeah. And, my mother was home, and so I didn't, but she had a lot of times, she had a lot of health issues, and so I ended up, and she was teaching music lessons after school, so I was cared for my younger siblings after school every day from a very early age, and really felt very responsible and not very childlike.
Oh, yeah. Lori was always the grown-up.
Yeah.
When she married and was on her own, I was then a baby only, which meant I needed to grow up pretty quickly.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. You're listening to Writer's Voices with Monica and Caroline. Our guest today is Goldie Taylor, author of The Love You Save. Well, Goldie, how did you escape from that trauma? It seemed like you had some teachers who were really good influences, and what allowed you to break free from that generational poverty and trauma?
I had extraordinary teachers who had very few resources. They had their own creativity, the innovations they could make for themselves. I talk about Peggy Lewis LeCompton in the book. I talk about John Forhan and Gerald Nave. These are teachers that I had in the East St. Louis District 189 area. They gave me everything from Mark Twain and Hemingway and William Ernest Henley to Margaret Walker and James Baldwin and these literary icons, Nikki Giovanni. They gave me all of these things. And when I had absorbed that, they gave me more. So I was receiving an education that I don't think many of my peers was getting. For some reason, I had been plucked out as something special. I had a chance to talk to Mrs. Comp last week about that. And she said, you know, we knew that you needed more. We didn't know what was happening at home for you. But there was something happening at home for everybody in our classrooms. What we did know is that you could take on a bit more in terms of responsibility, and we were there to give it to you. That was the game changer for me. That even meant that later on in life, when I fell down to depression, you know, when I fell down to not being able to, you know, be front and center for my own children every day, that when these traumas kept catching up with me, it was my writing, it was the things that I'd gotten in early school. I was able to write my way out of trouble, write a new essay and sell it to a local magazine, write a new press release and sell public relations services to a local company. I was able to write myself out of trouble more often than not, and it was because of the basic competency that I'd been given in middle school that never left me. And so I built an entire career on that. And so I've been on MSNBC and CNN and NBC News and, you know, places that I could not have imagined for myself as a child. And today I'm chief communications officer at a world-renowned cancer institute, where I work alongside heroes every day. I would not be here but for the diversity of those perspectives I was given in middle school.
Wow. Goldie, would you like to read a little bit from The Love You Save?
Sure. Let me grab my copy right here.
All right.
It's an exciting day for me to think that I have, you know, a book on the shelves.
Oh,
you know, thinking about
what
I have been talking about today, that's really part of the epilogue. More than anything, I think she simply needs somebody to listen. Daily phone calls with my mother are often littered with her tears. She complains of being overwhelmed. And at times, at 80, she is confused over the most routine matters. She's still haunted, I know, by my father's murder. Her weather-beaten skin seems to have darkened over the years, and she's racked with emotional maladies that assault her sense of balance. It is her trauma, I know, bottled up and undiluted. Grief, they say, is love with nowhere to go. Though it had spanned a mere 7 years, the tumultuous relationship, at times beautiful and at other times marred with animosity and violence, left an indelible mark on her psyche. But more than 4 decades after my father's murder, the memories of the man who loved my mother with an unbridled ferocity are both a pain and a refuge that only she can know. She has chosen largely to cope with the silence, with his absence. Over the years, though, she's wondered aloud, as I sometimes do, what would our lives have been? But it was Toni Morrison who said, love is never any better than the lover. Wicked people love wickedly. Violent people love violently. Weak people love weakly. And stupid people love stupidly. When it comes to my father, my mother speaks mostly of the joys and almost never of the sorrows. She leaves out the wicked, the violent, and the stupid. As a young woman, she was never the kind to wear her disappointments, preferring instead a fresh slick of lipstick, a whiff of the cleavage, showgirl eyelashes, and knee-high go-go boots. I suppose I inherited her sense of resilience, her steadiness amid tumult, if not her proclivity for sequin ball gowns, spaghetti strap stilettos, and lash extensions. Like my mother, I've been a platinum blonde one time too many. Similarly, we are both sometimes untrusting, cynical creatures, yet empathetic and benevolent in ways that sometimes leaves our spiritual and physical storehouses empty.
And that was Goldie Taylor reading from The Love You Save. So, Goldie, when you sat down to write this story, were you thinking it would be a published book, or were you just writing for yourself initially?
The initial essay was for me. I wanted to tell myself what happened to me. I shared it with my grown children because I wanted them to know. But it was my oldest daughter who asked the question, are you going to publish this? I thought, read it again, and said, you know, I think I have to. And so that first essay went live on the Daily Beast in August of 2019. Within days, the responses that we received by direct message, by text, by phone, everyone I knew read this essay that had by that time gone viral. Most of the calls that I received were of the Me Too variety. Mm. Not Me Too as in a stranger, but Me Too as in somebody I knew, someone familiar to our family. Not an employer, not a director, not another actor, but the boy down the street, the uncle who happened by every third Sunday. The more of those stories I heard, the more I knew that I had to write the rest of the story, that it was assumed that we'd all gotten the care that we needed. And I will talk about what I got.
Do you think that you will write more of your memoir? Because you kind of leave off where I'm, you know, we know that you turned out okay, that you definitely made something of yourself, but I'd like to know more of how that happened.
Sure. You know, we all know how this story ends, for sure. I think the next part of the story, though, is the now, that I am a middle-aged woman raising a 9-year-old. Mm. Why that is, how we got here, and how we get along from day to day, I think is the next story to tell. And through that, it will allow me to look back over those missing years, the gap between now.
Right,
but
right.
The next story.
I really enjoyed reading about your speech competition days. Can you tell us a little bit about that?
You know, I think that joining the speech and debate team, I mean, we didn't have a lot of money at Rock Junior High School to do a lot of things. The speech club didn't cost anything except a rented school bus to get the kids to and from the competition. And sometimes that was even in the teacher's cars. Peggy Lewis LeCompte handed me my first speech to deliver in competition. It's Margaret Walker's For My People. And I took to it like taking the testimony at our church. Mm-hmm. I took to it like one of the deacons would at Mount Pierre where I went to church. I won that first competition. They gave out these blue ribbons, 1, 2s, and 3s, and the judges had all given me 1s. I won this competition. I was so excited that I had won something. And, of course, I wanted to do it again. And so for the next few competitions, I was reciting Margaret Walker's For My People. But then my mother brought home to my aunt, she brought home a newspaper clipping. It was an Ann Landers column. And you might remember this Ann Landers column, many do.
It I do, yeah.
She brought that home to me, and I took it straight to Mrs. LeCompte. I said, this is my next speech. We took that column, which Ann Landers reprinted from time to time, and reformed it, used it as an entry for the Optimist Club. We were in Belleville, Illinois. And I was competing against high school seniors. And I performed in first person the story of a boy who was begging God for his life again as he talked about the day that he got into a crash, that he had drinks and got into a car and drove and regretted and wanted to take the whole day back. I recited that. I won that Optimist competition. And then I won the Optimist Regional with it. And in eighth grade, I won the Optimist State title with it. And that became sort of a bit of a signature piece for me, talking about drunk driving among teenagers. And I was in eighth grade and not old enough to drive myself. So that's where it began in eighth grade. By the time I got to ninth grade, I was still in junior high, but competing against high school students. And Mr. LeCount gave me another piece by that time. It was Charles Finn, The Mask We Wear. This one cut a little closer to home. I could see myself in Charles Finn's words. I could see other people in Charles Finn's words. Don't be fooled by me. Don't be fooled by the mask that we wear, for we all wear a mask. None of them is I. And I used that throughout my ninth grade year.
And that was an interpretive poetry?
Interpretive poetry.
Yeah.
We cut the down to fit the time limit. It is interpretive poetry. I won the state title with that. And with that, a meeting with then mayor of Chicago, Harold Washington.
Oh.
Said, gosh, you talk a lot.
And the success that you were having in these speech competitions also kind of changed your aunt's attitude towards you, didn't it?
It really did. Because those speeches spilled over into church as well.
Mm.
And was teaching Sunday school and testifying in church and evangelical. It was all of it ran together. My aunt was bursting with pride. She wanted to tell everyone. She always told everyone how well I did in school, but now she had something new, that my ninth grade niece is beating high school seniors. And she had something brand new. So she was proud. It didn't slow down how much, you know, how hard she was on me in terms of where I could or could not go. But those extracurriculars earned me, you know, a bit of liberty in terms of getting to the library on my own, what time I had to make it in from school, how many chores I had to do. You know, all of those things were fashioned around this budding extracurricular that I had going.
And being allowed to have more books.
Being allowed to have more books, I could take them out of Grandma Alice's closet and be out in the open.
Your Grandma Alice was also kind to you.
She was my co-conspirator. You know, if I needed to hide under somebody's skirt, her apron was ready.
Oh.
We hid books in her closet, you know, dues for this club or that one. She had a locked chiffon robe in her bedroom. It was a metal cabinet. She hung clothing in. And her purses and, you know, dresses were on one side. And my books and other things that I thought were valuable were on the other. And she carried the key around in her in her breast, in her brassiere.
Because you didn't have your own room.
I did not have my own room.
Or even your own bed.
I did not have a bed. From time to time, I got to sleep with Grandma Alice, but my place was with the other children on the living room floor. We slept on pallets every night. Oh. You know, children's backs are pretty resilient.
Yeah.
I don't know if I could sleep today. Don't think I could handle that poor sleeping today, but children's backs, I imagine, are pretty resilient.
Yeah, my granddaughter one time asked me, she said, why don't old people like sitting on the floor?
Because they can't get up.
And I said, do you think I'm old? And she goes, well, you don't look old.
My granddaughter is dead set that I am old and that I shouldn't sit on the floor. She's pretty clear. Yeah, pretty clear about that. Yeah.
Yep. You're listening to Writers' Voices, and our guest today is Goldie Taylor, author of The Love You Save. So you decided... this essay had gone viral, and with your children's encouragement, you decided, to publish it with their encouragement, and then it went viral, and you realized you needed to tell more of the story. How did things go from there? Because is this your first published book?
It is my fourth. I'd written three novels.
Oh, okay. So tell us a little bit about those.
Well, there were three. The first was self-published in my father's house. It's the story of a young Atlanta attorney who has a secret that her father is in jail serving life for a murder he didn't commit, that it was, in fact, his young daughter who shot the boy in the barn. who is now the attorney attempting to get him out of jail. The second book is The January Girl, also an Atlanta-based woman who is an investment banker, and she simply is, you know, a woman in search of love and finding it in truly all of the wrong places in all of the wrong people. We learn in the book that she's just really looking for herself. The last one is Paper Gods. And Paper Gods came out in 2018, and it is an Atlanta mayor who is chasing down these paper gods that, you know, they're a bit of ominous signs. Whenever they show up, someone dies. The mayor's out to solve these murders and stop the next ones from happening. And so it's a bit of a political thriller.
Well, and that was published, I'm seeing, by St. Martin's Press.
St. Martin's Press.
Yep. And was, how about January Girl?
January Girl came from Warner Books in Hachette.
Okay.
And in my father's house was self-published.
And The Love You Save is published by Hanover Square Press.
Hanover Square, HarperCollins, yes.
And how did you find your publisher?
Well, In My Father's House was a self-published title. I had no agent. I'd written 200 agents, and they all said no. And that was back in the day when you had to buy a self-addressed stamped envelope. You had to pay for them to tell you no. But I kept hold of that book. It was important to me. And then I gave it to a friend in New York City who happened to know someone at a Book of the Month club and handed the book over. I said, you know, this story is good, but we think she's got another one. And what do you think if we give her a small advance and she'll write us a second book? And I did. That was The January Girl, which was first produced by Book of the Month club. It was a terrific opportunity. But out of that came an agent named Larry Kirschbaum. And Larry at the time had been a former CEO of Warner Books and was now running LJK Literary Group. He led that book, and I'm pleased that he was, that he did. But he left and went back to publishing, and I was without an agent again.
Oh.
But I knew from then on that I would need an agent to get the kind of publishing deal that I wanted for myself. With this one, with The Love You Save, I met the agent because I was represented on the other side of the house for Paper Gods, and that Paper God was being optioned as a dramatic television series from John Legend at the time. And that agent introduced me to the literary side of the house. They pitched the book in January of 2020, and I went from having 200 agents tell me no to five major publishing houses saying yes, and we're going to bid for this.
Wow. So, congratulations.
A long way between one and the other. But that just says that, you know, maybe I was a fool for never giving up. Maybe there was something else I could have done better with my time. But I wanted only this. Wow. And so I stayed until it came.
Wow. So will you continue to write novels, or are you going to focus on memoir from here on?
You know, I think there are other novels here. I think there's at least one more memoir. But for now, I'm going to take a breath and see where the good Lord leads me.
Oh, wow. And you also do a lot of writing, journalistic writing as well. Can you tell me a little bit about that?
That's where I spend a grand portion of my time. I write for the Daily Beast, mostly social justice issues, most recently published in Time Magazine and Time Ideas, where I wrote about Tyree Nichols and the officers who murdered him in Memphis, Tennessee. I have written for Rolling Stone Magazine, where I wrote about the anti-Semitism of Kanye West and Kyrie Irving, how prevalent anti-Semitism can be in the Black community. And so I spend, you know, more of my public life in terms of essays writing about social issues, issues that I think are or should be important to all of us.
And what is the Daily Beast, and what's your work with them?
The Daily Beast is a new online news magazine that was launched I guess it's been almost 20 years ago, by Tina Brown, big time magazine editor, Lost the Daily Beast. Today, it is the intersection of politics and pop culture. And so they are as quick to write about, gun violence or a mass shooting in California as they are to write about, the State of the Union address. They are a publication with which I've got great latitude. I'm thankful to them to write about the things that are important to me, but they are a news magazine that has a heavy opinion side.
What is your writing process like? Like, when do you decide, okay, today I'm going to work on this novel or this memoir or this essay? How do you decide what? Because it sounds like you've got a lot of things going on. And how do you stay focused on what you're writing?
You know, I do. I have a full plate of raising a child and full-time senior executive job. But when there's a project afoot, like this essay in 2019, that I know I need to do personally something about, I will wake as early as 4 a.m. and spend 3 hours just at the page, free writing, letting myself fall apart. When I'm writing books, sure, there is an outline to work on. There's a spine to build. But for essays, it is mostly stream of consciousness, keep working, polishing, and working until you synthesize and get it right. But my process is that there are drafts, there are good drafts, and there are no drafts. To me, there's no such thing as a bad draft. You've got to get it down first. And if you continue editing and editing before you get it down, you might not ever have a work in the end. And so my process is just simply get the word down and then come back and give it its form.
So you're what they call a pantser rather than a plotter.
Yes.
And for people who've listened to the show, you've heard that term before. You know, so a pantser is you just get everything out there and then you come back and shape it later.
Yes.
Essentially, yeah, yeah.
Get it out there.
And do you sometimes not even know what shape it's going to be?
Well, I'm pretty good on form. And so I understand the shape of a novel, the shape of a memoir, the shape of an essay. And so I've got shape in my head. But I think every editor needs an even better editor. Every writer needs an exquisite editor. Mm. The world is made for revisions. Get it down first. Worry about the rest later.
That's good advice. Now, some of us like to, shape every word and perfect every word before we move on. And I can tell you from experience that often results in never finishing.
Well, a lot of people say, I think I've got a good book in me. I said, we will stay in there until you write it down.
Yeah, that's for sure. Now, do you write on computer?
I do. Yeah. I write on computer. I have carpal tunnel, and so I can no longer write by longhand.
Mm.
Yeah.
Did you start out that way? Well, of course you did back when you were first writing, because that's how we all did it back then.
Typing double space on a Royal. I started out when I was electric typewriter, but now the Mac keyboard is as good as I can do.
Do you remember how when you wrote out a paper, if you made a mistake, you sometimes had to type the whole page over again?
The whole page, and then they made whiteout.
Yes. Oh, wasn't that a miracle?
That was quite a miracle. And this is a comp class with carbon paper.
Oh, but then they also made, of course, with the carbon paper, that was tough. But they made those ribbons, the typewriter ribbons, where you could go back and type over it in the white.
The little whiteout that would fit the form of the key.
Yes, yeah.
That was quite an invention. That changed everyone's lives.
I know.
Whiteout.
And yeah, we used carbon paper because, there probably were copy machines, but we didn't have access to them.
We didn't have access to a copy machine, but
no.
Copy for editing purposes.
Ah.
Yeah.
So how did you get your first job in journalism?
I have been writing for college age, I was a grown woman. I had gone to the military, and in the Marine Corps, I trained as a broadcast journalist, which means they taught me how to write the news. When I got home, I figured out that didn't translate into having a commercial journalism job. I had to start over. And so I went back to college, went to Emory University in Atlanta, where I wrote for the Emory Wheel. And I took those clips down to the Atlanta Journal-Constitution on the advice of a friend, got a part-time job as a staff writer for $7.50 an hour with a cap of 25 hours a week. That was my first job in journalism.
Wow.
And that's where I got my start. That following summer, I did a post-undergrad internship at the local CBS 5 station in Atlanta. And those two things together were the beginnings of my journalism career. I was willing to do anything.
But it sounds like you always knew that this was the area you wanted to be in, journalism, writing, broadcasting.
This was always going to be my vocation, yes.
Yeah. Do you have a favorite job that you've had?
The one I have right now.
very good.
And no kidding you, I am I'm on the senior team at Dana-Farber Cancer Institute here in Boston. And, you know, we work to eradicate cancer. My job is to alleviate the burden of cancer for people here and around the world. And the people that I get to do it with every day, the people that we do it for and on behalf of, is probably, well, it is, the most rewarding professional experience I've ever had. Mm. A place where mutual trust and respect are the order of the day, where kindness is a given, compassion is a given. To see people fighting cancer and struggling with it with such courage, with such intention, is simply an inspiration, I think, to all of us who do this work. So being here at Dana-Farber, doing, I know that what we do here changes lives everywhere. I truly understand that, and I could not be more grateful to be a part of it.
Wow. You're listening to Writer's Voices, and our guest today is Goldie Taylor, author of The Love You Save, a memoir. We just have a few minutes left, but let's go back to East St. Louis. Have you been back to East St. Louis? What's it like there now?
You know, I go back to St. Louis every several years in East St. Louis. Each time I go, it feels, there's a feeling of desolate there. Mm-hmm. That if you walk down our old street, 10th Street, which is now called Catherine Dunham Avenue, you walk down Catherine Dunham Street, if there were, say, 25 homes between 9th and 10th Street between our two blocks, let's just say there were 25, there are only 3 still standing.
Oh, wow.
That they just simply aren't there. They're overgrown lots that sit between some of the homes that are still standing, should be or will be condemned. There were over 55,000 people living in East St. Louis when I was growing up in the 70s. Today, that number is less than 15,000. And so the tax base was ripped away. When you do get a job that you can put more than 15 cents together, you simply move away. There is no industry other than the school board and a few convenience stores, service stations.
So, and part of the decline was due to, like you said, the tax base literally being ripped away.
Yes.
Segregation. Intentionally.
Intentionally.
Yeah.
Segregation, building St. Louis. Yeah. Literally redrew the city's boundaries so that the businesses, and they reincorporated a town called Sauget, S-A-U-G-E-T. They reincorporated Sauget, Illinois, so that it became the business center, and they no longer paid taxes to the city of East St. Louis, so there was no longer any support for schools or anything else. They redrew the city's boundaries so that businesses wouldn't have to pay taxes into a city of black people.
That they probably relied on for their workforce. It's so short-sighted, not to mention cruel, but just it's short-sighted. I don't understand what people are thinking when they do things like that. I mean, I do understand, but I think it's stupid.
Yeah, it's unfortunate, but St. Louis has paid the cost over time, and the hope of it rebounding, you know, it's tough to think that they can from here.
Is Ferguson nearby?
Ferguson is about 15 miles away. Yeah. It sits sort of mid-distance between St. Anne and East St. Louis along I-70. I went to Ferguson when I was around 18. Ferguson is my home of record when I left for the Marine Corps. Ferguson was a sundown town when we were growing up. You couldn't be in Ferguson after sundown. Today, Ferguson is a highly diverse township that sits in the shadow of University of Missouri St. Louis off of Hanley Road, but it sits right in the middle, yes.
Wow. Well, we're about out of time, Goldie, and I did want to mention that there's elements of the story of your book, The Love You Save, that there's a TV show I've been watching recently that there's some similarities, and that's the one Octavia Spencer stars in. I think it's The Truth Be Told.
Yes, I'm watching. I'm on the first season.
Oh, yeah. So there's some great similarities between them, between your story and hers in that show. So thank you so much for being with us. We always end with a quote, and this is the quote that I found for today. Trauma in a person decontextualized over time looks like personality. Trauma in a family decontextualized over time looks like family traits. Trauma in a people decontextualized over time looks like culture.
Oh, good.
And that's from Rezma Menachem.
Oh, my gosh. Oh, my goodness. I feel every bit of that. Absolutely.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much for being with us today, Goldie.
Thank you for having me, Monica. And thanks for coming.
And see you all next week on Writers' Voices.